Ladies, gentlemen, and others, welcome to another episode of Human Energy Field. I'll be your host, Henry. I'm here yet again with my co-host, Jamie. This episode, we want to really talk to you about art in RPGs, art in books, graphic design. So that's going to take up the kind of bulk of the episode. And then towards the end, as usual, we'll be doing our movie and album segments. Jamie's picked the movie this time, guys. Oh, boy.
Well, you know, when it's my turn to pick a movie, it's going to be a good one, isn't it? So,
yeah, that's debatable. We'll get to that when we come to it. So stay tuned later on because things are going to get a little bit diverse, I think. And I've picked an album as well, which we'll get to later on. That also includes some good art and some pretty heavy riffage. So stay tuned until the end of the episode. We'll be talking about that. Probably signing off with a song there as well. But the bulk of the episode this time, we really want to discuss art, its importance, and how it affects nearly everything around us. And to do that, we've asked friend of the show, Patrick, to come on and join us. Patrick himself is an artist, so hopefully he'll be the one with an actual bit of technological input, expertise input into this conversation. So, Patrick, you're an artist, mate. Could you tell us a little bit more about your sort of styles and your mediums you work with and your background and that kind of thing? Welcome on, of course.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Geez, what a question. Yes, background as an artist. I can start maybe with my current education or my current kind of field is that I'm an art educator. I run a printmaking workshop at a university in Germany. Before that, I ran a similar shop in a university in Stockholm. And, you know, leading up to that, I did study art and fine art, like studio art or whatever you call it in English. And I guess that's the basis. And that, you know, the desire to study art comes from an interest in art, a lifelong interest.
I think it's worth mentioning, for full disclosure, that... me and Patrick playing the same game. We play online quite a lot. We have done for all of this year. So Patrick's obviously a very keen role player as well, which makes him perfect for this episode. So we can talk about art and role playing games. So it's not just your art, but obviously your love in role playing games as well, which we all do. So that's good.
Yeah, there is a confluence between those two that we like to mold together. Something we want to stress definitely here on Human Energy Field, where we like to talk about RPGs. Okay, I mean, first of all, guys, I don't know about you. I had a little list of artists that I really like that I want to talk about.
Oh, are we gonna go straight into favorite RPG artists? Are we just going straight there? Are we?
I mean, where else is there to go at this point?
Okay, yeah, let's do it, Henry. Kick it off.
where else is there for us to go? The first guy I'll come up with, you know, when I knew we were going to do this episode, and one of the first names that come to my head, Angus McBride. And I'm sure that it's someone that you are also quite familiar with, but I think we have different, we've come in at different angles about where his work that he's done and that kind of thing. I don't know, Patrick, if you're familiar with the works of Angus McBride.
Googling him now.
Smart, very clever, I like it. So Angus McBride, he did a lot of historical illustrations, and he's also done a lot of work for the Middle-earth role-playing game. Jamie's nodding his head. Jamie, do you want to talk to us a little bit about that kind of classic era fantasy covers and stuff like that?
Yes, I mean, to be honest, there's only a handful of artists whose work are almost synonymous with Middle-earth, and Angus McBride's work is so familiar to anyone who played the Middle-earth role-playing game back in the 80s. I mean, his full covers are just bring this real, realistic, almost Osprey historical bent to the front of these MERP covers, and they're absolutely wonderful. There is actually a source book of just that contains just Angus McBride images and the description of the image and stats to go with the people who are in the image, and it's all these classic Middle Earth scenes, you know. The hobbits in the Ents' hands, and you know, the death of Boromir, and all these kind of amazing things. So yeah, I personally know Angus McBride's work from the Middle Earth covers, but I was briefly aware he did loads of historical stuff. But you seem to have come from him from the historical side of things, then.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Osprey Publications was his main kind of output in terms of historical illustrations. You know, he's done all sorts of stuff from like medieval Scandinavian knights to like mounted archers on the steppe. Some of the first illustrations I found of his were a book called Rome's Enemies, and it's about the Celtic tribes and the Gallic tribes. And his illustrations of ancient Celts and Gauls are like some of the most iconic drawings of the people from that time period that I've ever seen, and they're very, very inspirational to me. And he's just got this way with the way he sketches and draws, and he puts movement into these figures. It's really iconic work. What do you think, Patrick? Now you've seen him.
Now that I've seen him, yeah, like they look familiar. I wasn't aware of the name. I mean, it's great Viking stuff. It looks amazing.
So come on then, Paro, tell us one of your favorites. Well, I guess we just have to pick one now, but what your favorite role-playing game artist?
Well, you know, like when you asked me to come on, I was like, okay, I should do my homework a bit and look at some names. And it's really hard to tell. I've got a list of like 10, 15, but it's so diverse.
We can talk about some of the others, but if you were forced to pick one.
If I were forced to pick one, Tony Dieterlizzi.
Something
like that.
Straight in there with a legend.
Yeah, just garbling his name, sorry. I think those were extremely evocative to me and somehow groundbreaking in the stuff that I saw because they were watercolors. And that just really... like artsy watercolors, you know.
He did the stuff for Planescape.
Yeah, he was the main artistic direction on Planescape, absolutely. And he did. He's done quite a lot of his fantasy work in AD&D and a lot of Monsters Compendium work, and as you say, especially Planescape. What was the movie that was based on his fairy art? He did a fairy book, and they did a movie based on it. The Spiderwick Chronicles.
Wow. Right.
So for anyone who
is that based on his work?
It is, yeah. Even down to the designs of the kind of trolls and the goblins and everything, you can really see his work, and it's been presented on the screen. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it is a child's movie. It's like a teenager's movie, but it's well worth, if you're looking for something to watch in an afternoon, The Spiderwick Chronicles is amazing because it ticks all of those kind of folkloric fairy boxes, and his artwork just really shines through in the books and the movie and everything. So yeah, he's such a good artist.
That's a great pick. Patrick, is there one piece that kind of stands out as something that appeared in your mind immediately?
Probably Wolves of the Sea. I think it's where White Wolf Dark Ages or something like this. I can't remember. Vampire Dark Ages, maybe.
Yeah.
I think this quality of dreamlike but really dark and heavy images at the same time, I really like that.
I have to throw in a little nugget of wisdom about Wolves of the Sea.
Go for it.
That's what you're here for, mate.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. For people listening, obviously Vampire the Dark Ages was the historical game to Vampire the Masquerade. What was really unusual about Wolves of the Sea, which was a Viking source book for that spin-off game, is it was set about 500-600 years before the actual campaign time. Vampire the Dark Age was designed to be played in around 1197 was the official start time. But obviously they had to take certain liberties with playing as kind of Vikings and etc. So that one source book doesn't actually tie in with all of the others. It kind of stands alone. There's a bit of an intro at the beginning that says, you know, look, if you want to include Vikings in your Dark Ages game, then go for it. Don't worry about historical accuracy. But it also is careful to tell you that the timelines don't really add up. So, but it's a great book, and that cover is absolutely fantastic. But I think also to before we move on from Dieterlizzi, I was aware of his work on Planescape, but it was really Changeling the Dreaming, the original White Wolf fairy game, that really highlighted his work for me, because his full page art in that is just, it's phenomenal.
Okay, I might have messed up there, isn't it? Richard Ferguson.
And, yes.
Danger. All right, rewind everything. Boot Patrick off the podcast.
Tony Lizzie is fine, and Richard Kane Ferguson is also brilliant. But
I think it actually might be him.
Just changed. Yeah, do you know what? I mean, I can see it now. It's the Viking warrior at the front on the cover, but my memory's hazy about the artist on the front, so I just assumed you were right. But there you go, Richard Kane Ferguson, even better. So before you have to message us and write in and tell us we're wrong, we've corrected ourselves.
Yeah, put your phones down, people. Put your phones down. Yeah. We're all good. We do it ourselves if we can. To solve your problems, you have to own them.
Yeah. So that one's on me.
But to focus on front covers then, because Wolves of the Sea front cover is clearly something that's quite iconic. So what is it about a front cover that you guys think is going to make it stand out in people's minds, or is going to make you pull that book off the shelf? What is it about a front cover, do you think?
Go on, Parry.
I think I really like the front cover to sort of draw me in and like sell me whatever it wants, whatever the book will want to sell me in a lot of text. And I'm thinking of the Shadowrun cover, for instance. It's perfect. It's you can run the entire game of Shadowrun based on the cover. I didn't look up the artist, but
I think it's Larry Elmore. I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well,
I think
Larry
it might be Elmore.
Okay.
I think so.
Okay. Gonna have to check that. I can only talk or type. I think I'm just gonna, keep going. I think you've got Sally Tsung standing there. You've got like some sort of Dodger type of hacking going on. You've got a person that might very well be Ghost from the novel standing there. It's like everything, the entire cool of the game is happening on the cover, and that's why I think it's amazing.
I think for reference for some people who may be coming into Shadowrun a little bit later, you're talking about the classic cover to Shadowrun, so you're talking about the Shadowrun 1, Shadowrun 2 cover, whereas I think it changed from 3rd edition onwards. So, yeah, that classic cover really is a kind of action sequence and just kind of highlights a lot of the kind of elements that Shadowrun's famous for all in one picture. And I guess it's that old adage of, a picture paints a thousand words, isn't it?
I like the way you said that, Patrick, about how the entire cool of the game is on the front cover. That's a really good way of putting it, because it does have to kind of show you what you're in for in a way as well. That's why I like the Vampire the Masquerade 2nd edition cover with the lady with the leather jacket and the sunglasses on.
That's the cover for the Player's Guide, my friend.
Player's Guide, there you go.
Yeah, the cover for the core book is actually just the green marble with the red rose.
But that in itself, you look at that front cover, and I'm a latecomer to that franchise, but that is something that's memorable for me, because in that single figure, not even in the whole frame, but just the person in the center of the image, this vampiric woman. It tells you everything you need to know. She's got a leather jacket and these big thick sunglasses on, these Ray-Bans, and she's like, her hair's all wild and she's just like a metal chick. And without looking at anything else, without even needing to see any blood, I'm like, I want to play that game. That looks awesome. You have to kind of convey the message, don't you, as effectively as you can.
Okay, so here's a good question, play devil's advocate. Then I'm going to throw this question out at our guest, Patrick. If an RPG has a poor cover, is that enough to put you off picking it up and buying it?
No, but I mean, it depends on sort of how I will kind of buy a book. I think a lot for me about also collecting RPG books or sort of going to fairs is, I think they don't really exist that much anymore. Not that we get into like some old men talking about role-playing game books kind of thing, but I used to go to fairs and they'd have like these stacks of like boxes of books, and you just sort of flip through them, and they'd obviously being German, English books would be not price bound. So they just put these stacks of books on, and the best, sweetest deals or, not translated works you'd get from these boxes, and flicking through them, I'm not going to read the backsides. Either I know what I'm looking for, or I'm going to be stopped by an art piece.
How does that work? I just wanted to stop you there, just to for other people who might not be familiar, like I'm not, with the price thing there. So is the pricing different because the book was in English? How does that work?
Yes. Well, the thing is, I think if you publish a book in German, it gets like an ISBN number and all this stuff, and it has to have a recommended price, and for a certain amount of time, like years or whatever, a book released in Germany can only be reduced if it's damaged goods. So okay. in lots of like stores, you'd have like, you know, you have perfect books, but they all have to have a sticker on it which says like preisreduziertes Mängelexemplar. Everyone hunting for secondhand books will know this. That's the only way you can sort of escape the price binding. And imported books will not have this binding that you're not. I think it's some rule of fair game among bookstores or something that you know, that big chains can't like dump the prices and sort of boot smaller. So that's it, you know.
Would this affect, just from a collector's point of view, I'm interested, mm-hmm. does this affect the price upwards as well or just downwards?
Well, I think upwards is a whole different, I think this goes for downwards prices.
Right, okay.
This is for, you know, for selling off stock, and especially with a lot of role-playing game books that then come in second, third edition or something like this, you know, at some point you're like, you know, there's always this sweet time when a game, you know, from a collector's point of view, goes out of fashion and gets replaced by the new thing. And then you, for a while, you can get the books cheaper until you realize there aren't any books of this. And then people will want to sort of, you know, have a harder and harder time hunting them down. So the price goes up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Things like that. But to go back to your original question, would I... if the cover is poor or bad, yeah, I might actually just like flip over it. You know, if it looks sort of not appealing, like it's hard to bash a book now and I think of a non-appealing book. But, you know, Old Traveler didn't even have any images on it, doesn't need it because it's hard sci-fi.
The original Traveler that you're referencing didn't even have any internal artwork, never mind about it.
Right, yeah.
It's just, it was devoid of artwork entirely.
That's how I like my books. That's the way I like them.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if we go for content, if a mate would recommend a book to me, you know, based on, you know, if you say you need to pick this up because it's good, then that's going to be the entryway, and it's not going to need like an eye candy. But more often than not, I think, you know, It's a field where we want to go in and play and like suspend our disbelief and have some great time. And for that, I want to be met halfway. Because if I have to work really hard to sort of sell a concept, sell a story, sell it to my players also, then I want help.
That's a great
Okay,
point.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah, you make a really interesting point. So this what makes me think here is, so you think if an RPG has a certain solid art direction, it makes your job as a GM easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or a player.
Or a player, yeah.
And, you know, there's games that are, like, fully designed, and we'll probably talk about them a bit later, but there is, I think, you know, we've got the sort of old style, you write a book because, you know, you're a nerd and you think of some sort of, you know, Planescape world and whatever, and then you put out the monster manual, the player's handbook, and so on. And there's the other ones where during the creation process, art design was already a thing. You didn't later approach artists and piece by piece kind of, you know, fill it with like 25 different works of different illustrators, but you have one vision of how you want your product then to look. And I think that took a lot of time in the genesis of role-playing games, I suppose, at least for me, you know, that you realize like, oh, if I have one, you know, art direction, I get a more consistent visual world.
I must admit, I think the RPGs that have some of the strongest art direction tend to have the work of only one artist or a small handful of artists in their pages rather than a real wide variety.
What comes to your mind there, then?
Well, straight off my mind, I'm thinking about the early White Wolf books, and I remember there was quite a small artistic team. Obviously, Timothy Bradstreet's amazing portraits are really iconic.
Yeah,
are really iconic to early vampire. But I think because they had such a small selection of internal artists, there was a real consistent feel. And I think going to Vampire the Dark Ages, when there's so much Guy Davis artwork, And he was going to be my pick for favorite artist, so I can kind of squeeze him in there. Because almost all of the art was Guy Davis artwork, you felt like you were entering this world, this consistent world where the writing meets the art, and then the art is all the same throughout the book, which is amazing. Whereas I think some RPGs, when you get a great piece of art, and then you read three or four pages onwards and you have a lackluster piece of art, that can really bring the mood down. And I feel it becomes confused at that point. So I think that's why there was a handful of artists, especially in the golden age of RPGs in the late 80s and early 90s, where we have these superstars of RPG art, like Timothy Bradstreet, like Tony Ditalizzi, like Angus McBride, like Larry McDougall, all of those names. And if you were lucky enough to have, or lucky enough to have the money to pay for these artists, then your book had a certain credence to it already. Whereas if you couldn't afford that kind of art, you just had to deal with something that maybe isn't quite as impressive. And that would have done your books a disservice, sitting on a shelf next to the artists of which I've just described.
I almost feel like the kid who wrote Sky Realms of Jorun and got those Renaissance painting artists to come and do the front covers. Like, really looked out there, didn't he, on that campaign?
Absolutely, yeah.
I guess you could sort of equate it to flipping through vinyls in a record store, but one difference I would make between that is when you pick up a vinyl, all you have is the front cover to sell you on that product, assuming that you're in a record shop flipping through vinyls, I mean. Whereas with an RPG book, the cover might be bad, but you might have heard that the engine is good, or there's good mechanics in it, or your friend has run the game. There's a lot out of it, it's a lot deeper, I think, when it comes to books than it is with vinyls.
I don't know, because you can look through vinyls with the same kind of knowledge that people have mentioned certain bands are good or artists are good. So you can almost maybe look past that, It's kind of similar. But what we're really talking about, in essence, is judging a book by its cover, aren't we? That's what we're discussing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So, and I guess, there is a truism in that. I mean, that is, and especially as the scenario you've just presented there, Patrick, where you're flicking, we've all been flicking through books, either in a secondhand shop or at a trade fair or anything, and you've got a limited amount of time, there's a queue behind you, there's a whole bunch of people, you've got to make snap decisions about what you're going to buy. And yeah, I guess you've kind of got to judge a front cover, which is why I think sometimes those front covers that are very kind of bland, almost like Traveller or Early Vampire, or they're brave because the cover gives nothing away.
I mean, that's all the original sort of World of Darkness books. They're by design reduced, which is nice because you can't get offended by like what you personally perceive as a bad illustration. And
do you think the early White Wolf books were really the beginning of the RPG RPG industry taking art seriously?
Oh, I don't know. That's a hard question, man. I don't know.
I just wonder, because I think that TSR and Dungeons and Dragons, obviously being the big boy, the early company, of course it had amazing artists drawing internal artwork, and covers weren't amazing, but Jeff Easley and Errol Lottis, and there's a lot of these classic names that people will know. But I don't think TSR really stepped up their art game until second edition, until you start getting Tony Ditalizzi on Planescape, which we've already mentioned, getting Brom on Dark Sun, which was just an absolutely mind-blowing artistic direction for Dark Sun. I just wonder whether White Wolf really took this, maybe not the forerunners, but maybe they took it to another level, and they really considered art as important as anything else.
I think they definitely did when they came around to, say, publishing Wraith. Because that book has a really distinct feel to it. They did it, I think, for later, Wild West Werewolf, like books that are thematically closer in itself, sort of. I think, you can open Wraith anywhere and it's always grey and depressing and slightly horrible. And that's amazing.
Yeah, but then I guess what we're doing is at that point, you're not even just judging it from its cover. You flick through the book, and you've got this consistent atmosphere,
exactly.
which is a great advert for what the game is, because Wraith is nothing if it is not grey and depressing. So, I mean, it does what it says on the tin, which is great for Wraith.
So there's internal art, which helps set the tone, and the formatting of the pages as well, where the words are and how big the words are. I know a lot of the World of Darkness books, you have your song lyrics in your kind of sketchy font that's a different size to the body, the text underneath it, and that kind of thing. So it's the art and it's the formatting of the pages as well, isn't it, that kind of goes together to set that tone.
I think you make a really good point about size of print, because it harkens back to a private conversation me and Patrick have had recently about different books and the print size on the pages. And I think that affects how much bang for your buck you're kind of getting. And if I open a book and there's huge word count per page and not a lot of art, I'm probably in the minority, because I think, oh, wow, I'm getting lots of content here.
Yeah, content.
That's what I love. Because I'm looking at going, there's great word count here. I'm getting lots of information. I'm getting lots of help. I'm getting lots of useful tools. Whereas I think art is great the first time I look at it, and it inspires me. But after that, the artwork in a rule book is kind of superfluous. It ceases to serve its purpose after a short amount of time. Or am I reducing artwork too much there, do you think?
I don't know. Like, when thinking, for instance, of Shadowrun, I think sort of the majority of my love for the game comes from, I think, second edition Jeff Laubenstein's depictions of the characters. And I think I still go back to that. Like, it makes me happy every time I, you know, would introduce the game to someone else. I'd be like, look at this. You can flick through. There's, you know, different archetypes of who and what you could be. And you got a visual to it, how that works. You know, like how that would look like. How, you know, the cool, for instance, of the game. And then I guess the Angus... Timothy Bradstreet. I mean, that's gothic punk horror, like right there. It's like, this is exactly how vampire is supposed to look to me, at least.
I know exactly what you're saying. I have to mention, for people who may not have the early Shadowrun source books, or may have them on the shelf and haven't looked at them for a long time, or may come across them in a secondhand bookstore for as long as secondhand bookstores exist. The early Shadowrun source books, flick through them, go to the middle, and you will find a selection of color pages, which are normally a little bit zany, a little bit crazy, a little bit out there. And actually, I think the worst parts of some of the early Shadowrun source books is the terrible art in the color pages in the center. So it's a real, it's interesting, because I do agree with you that Shadowrun's art direction is so important to the game and is on the whole of a very, very, very high standard. But there is some really cheesy art in those early source books.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
That's great. So it can also be a detriment to the book. It could do it a disservice, in other words, if the writing is up to a standard that the art doesn't meet.
Yeah, I guess the art is easy to ignore. I mean, I really understand what Jay is saying. It's, you know, like, yes, it's amazing, and it's a but you're not stopping at the illustration for as long as you're stopping, at the description of the mechanic that allows your, you know, character to do whatever they want to be doing in that moment. So, yes, you have to go to the content. And since you've already referenced that conversation that was talking about, like, bang for a buck, so to speak, as in how much text you have in the book, and so then playing devil's advocate the other way around, where I was thinking maybe a larger sort of font and an easier flow among the pages makes the book more accessible, makes it sort of, you know, a bit further from the classic history affectionate nerd that is loves to pore over the Silmarillion and sort of memorizes fictional dates with an ease that is amazing to me to this day, and maybe makes it a bit easier for someone who's would be normally taken aback by having to read a 300-page book.
So we're specifically talking about, you picked up a copy of the Overlight RPG, right, Patrick?
Yes.
And Overlight. That's inspired me. Overlight, yeah. So I've ordered one, but I haven't received it yet either. It's fairly new on the market. So actually, I would like this opportunity to, what's your initial thoughts and takes on Overlight? Because I'd be interested to hear, and I'm sure a lot of other people would be interested to hear as well, because it's not one that's getting a huge amount of coverage. It passed me by until you mentioned it. So tell us your initial thoughts on Overlight, Patrick.
Okay, so Overlight is, I saw Overlight when I went to the Spiel 2018 in Essen. It's a large game fair. I used to go there regularly when I used to live in Germany back in the day, and when I, you know, was ambitious about collecting books. And I was there in 19, I don't know. And I think it was the Kickstarter funded book that was released, and it was only that you could only get the book there as a pickup. Like, they didn't have enough copies to give to anyone that was present. And it's called Kaleidoscopic Gaming, or a Kaleidoscopic Fantasy. And they've taken, so basically, spoiler alerts, the world has been shattered. It's turned inside out. Like, what used to be the light inside the earth is now the overlight that shines down onto shards of continents, or like things that like float in the middle of nowhere. There's a black sea underneath, and there's no time, there's no day and night, and you as a skyborn person, you refract this overlight that comes down, sort of like a prison. Think Pink Floyd. And depending on which light you're refracting it into, you can choose different powers out of it. I think it's like, wow, you know, classic sanguine, what's it, you know, humor sort of theory with a color cool. And so the book is visually rainbow colored, very bright, very light. The entire world is very light, because it must be incredibly annoying to have pure white sky with pure white light coming down. There's no dark. I mean, there is dark, like, as in the further you go in this, like, plateaus of shards that float there, like, they block the light. So the deeper you go, the less light filters down. And and it's just very, very visual. And I kind of looked at the stuff when they had their stand, and I was like, and it's somehow stuck somewhere. So I don't know how this happened, but like, A couple of weeks ago, I ordered it.
You were saying that in their page, their word count per page is quite low, isn't it? So the text is quite large.
Yeah, like the first thing that when I got it and opened it, I was like, oh wow, this is really big font. Like, you know, it's not something that I would normally notice, but I opened it and I was like, oh, this is a really big font. And it hasn't bothered me in my read through yet. But it's noticeable when you compare it to other books.
So when you first looked at it and you were saying it's 2018, were you picking it up in German or English? Or
I know it's only English. I don't think there is any translations. Right. It's okay. By Renegade Games, and I think they're known for publishing board games, and which is maybe why it's been under the radar, or sort of. I mean, I would have to say I don't follow current news. I don't know what games are being published or something. It's like, and I'm not in any message boards where I don't have, you know, unlike you, I don't have a feeling that I should be knowing what comes out, because you know, I consider myself casual.
I did notice when I first looked online to purchase a copy that one of the first things I saw that popped up was a dice set. Is that dice set, is it a unique dice, or is it just regular polyhedrals with in a cool design? Because obviously I haven't read the book yet.
I think it's they had a stretch goals in the Kickstarter, and so they've got, I think, actually a quite interesting mechanic. The target roll is like, now we're going to talk mechanics for a second, unless
it's all interrupt good. That's me. Why we're here.
the target roll is always six, and your sort of attributes, they're called virtues, and the base is a D6, and you can spend more points to purchase higher, higher polygon count, so to speak. So you can have a D8, you can have a D10, and a D12, making it easier to get successes, because only rolling a 6 or higher is a success. And you've got something called like spirit dice or something, which is a D4, which you get to re-roll. No, when it's a 4, you get to add that to your success, because it has sort of like... I only know the German word for it. Like in Shadowrun, when you'd get 2 successes, you'd add up to the damage or something like that. I'm sure, right, like, or okay. 3 successes, depending on like some damage you had, like a whatever, like a 2. Like they unified it at like version 2. It was it's always been 2. With every 2 successes, you'd increase like the damage or something.
What they used to call a staging modifier.
Yeah,
maybe. Damage. In Shadowrun, yeah, that's what they called it. It was a staging modifier for damage. So however many successes you would have would jump up to the next severity of wounds in original Shadowrun, but then they codified that to just be a standard 2 successes per damage level. And that was really one of the only minor differences between Shadowrun 1 and Shadowrun 2. So
exactly. Yeah. And in Overlight, it's like this, that... 1 success is still considered a failure. You need 2 successes for it to be a luminous success, and then you need 4 successes for it to reach, like, you need an even number of successes to reach like the new tier, so to speak, which sort of goes along with the dice.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it reminds me of reading, and I know I'm guilty of dragging everything back to Early White Wolf, and I'm sorry, yeah, I'm a white boy, but It reminds me of reading the original mechanics for Vampire the Masquerade, where 1 success actually was only meant to be a partial success. Mm. And you know, I think 3 successes was considered complete success. Whereas most games that I've played in and even run, to admit, most of the time, if you get a success, you would consider the character has achieved whatever they set out to do. When really, that mechanic was not set out that way. You know, 1 should have almost been what we would now call an indie game's success with drawback, really.
Partial success, something like that.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
But back to the die set, it's actually, it's sort of just the 7 colors. It's purple, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. Maybe that's 6, I can't count.
Okay.
And I think that was a stretch goal. I think it is one of these games which is, has an annoying amount of dice that you need to have, because you're going to need like 3d12, 3d10, 3d8, and so on. So I guess now these sort of, you know, multi-sets make sense, that as a hardcore Shadowrun gamer back in the day, I never understood like why you had to buy like a D of everything, you know, when you could just buy a whole bunch of D6, because you'd need like 36 of them anyway.
Yeah,
so, you know,
this game sounds like the mechanics are kaleidoscopic as well in that sense.
I think they're actually fairly straightforward once you've got them, but like in the beginning you're like, wait, what? It's kind of nice somehow. And I think then you get like, you know, a pool. So you have 3 dice of 1, you know, persuasion, like an 3d8, 3d6, and then you've got like your spirit dice.
Right,
and
you
can pick like a chroma, like your character is specially attuned to 1 wavelength of this light. So that's sort of that's how your specialty, you know, be it might or something like that. So I kind of like what they did, because they really took this sort of color concept and forced it on the entire game. And sometimes that works beautifully.
Art being a unifying theme throughout the game. So having that bleed into the mechanics as well, it makes sense, doesn't it? That's great.
Yeah, it does.
I'm intrigued about this game now, Patrick. I'm going to go and look it up and see what it's all about.
Can I take us on a slight tangent here? And I think it still fits within the art umbrella that we're discussing. And you mentioned the dice, which was a Kickstarter goal. Now, my views on Kickstarter are not ultra positive. But that aside, I want to throw out as a question how we feel about all of these extras that we tend to get on Kickstarter campaigns. So special dice sets, art prints, whatever it might be, special, maybe sometimes even card decks or action decks or tarot decks or whatever. Do we feel that these additional Kickstarter toys add anything to the game, or are they merely something that is just designed to, the capitalist machine and kind of steal your money off you?
Well, I'll pass this hot potato straight over to Patrick if you want to take that one first, mate.
I feel you've dodged most of the questions so far, let's do it like this. I ran a Kickstarter in 2018 that was to move a vintage printing press built in 1904 from Switzerland to my print shop in Sweden, and since running this successful Kickstarter and moving a 7.5-ton cast iron press from Switzerland to Sweden, I really understand why you have to add stretch goals and why you have to add incentives, because
that's crowdfunding, my friend. That is how you crowdfund, right there.
That is how you crowdfund, and you realize that people are really sympathetic to your cause, and there is going to be, a bunch of friends that will just sort of donate money because they just, hopefully love you for what you do and they want you to succeed, but the majority of people will want something for it. And I think in that case, I don't know why Overlight decided, for instance, to come up with these die sets. That is a fairly straightforward way to give someone who wants to support your project, maybe. I mean, of course, they're also selling a product. I'm actually, saving a thing from destruction. I guess you need to have them. That's just the platform demands it.
I guess,
Not saying this is a good or bad thing, but I say it's like built in the system somehow.
I think to defend myself slightly, I'm not saying that there are not, great uses for Kickstarter, and it's achieved a lot of things that probably wouldn't have been achieved if that hadn't been the case or whatever. But without getting too much into the Kickstarter debate, there are a lot of companies who are using Kickstarter who financially do not need to use Kickstarter. So it's kind of lazy, they already have a product and they're just getting advance orders on it and then making people wait a long time. So I think to narrow down the focus of my question was, in large Kickstarters like 7th Sea or Vampire or Cult, wherever these big games that go to RPG Kickstarters, what you'll tend to find is a lot of the stretch goals are items that are actually, they're not necessary to play the game. They tend to be, a fancy dice bag or a set of metal dice or, a leather character sheet or, some nonsense. And I just think at that point, are you adding value to the game or are you almost devaluing it?
I think there is a difference between adding things around the game, whether it's novelty items like you've described, and there's a difference between adding things like that and actually affecting the product that you set out with originally. And I think there's a difference between the two. If I put a rule book on Kickstarter, I say, look, you can buy this core book for whatever it might be. If I reach stretch goals, I'm going to make t-shirts, I'm going to do posters and prints and maybe get some music recorded. That might be completely bloated. It might be completely out of proportion with what I'm doing, but the rule book that I've written isn't going to change as an item. So then really, what's the harm? People, the money's gone in, you've got to do something with it. Whereas on the other side of that argument, just quickly, for an example, I know you guys aren't video game people, but I recently played a game called Wasteland 3. Now, I backed Wasteland 3 on Kickstarter maybe like 4 years ago, whenever the crowdfunding happened. So I've been waiting a long time for this game. And they made so much money on the Kickstarter, they had to come up with these stretch goals to justify the amount of money they were getting. And one of the stretch goals they came up with was, okay, well, all the characters in the game are going to have full voice acting. We've got all this money. We've got to have to hire voice actors now to come in and voice every single character and every single line of dialogue, so we have to justify having this money somewhere. And in a way, that ruined the game for me a little bit, because the voice acting is shit. I don't need to hear everyone. I'm skipping through half the lines anyway. So there is a difference, because that did affect the product in a way that was a negative, whereas with a book, it wouldn't be the same. It's just bloated periphery.
All right, okay. Let's keep this to RPGs, okay? So I'm producing an RPG, and I have a core book, and it's $49.95 for a hardcover 300-page count book. I am putting it on Kickstarter. I want people to back it, and what they will receive is a hardback 300-page book. Now, why do I need to add stretch goals to that? Somebody who wants to back my project can back it for whatever the price is, $49.95, and they will get the book. For me to increase a lot of stretch goals means that I am actually decreasing the number of people I'm selling it to and increasing the number of money I'm getting out of each person, which means that the game isn't actually as successful as it looks like it is for the amount of money that's being made. So to me, if the product is good enough to attract people to pay $49.95 up ahead of time, why am I saying, oh, well, the stretch goal is, you know, if we make this much money, I'm going to throw in this? No, I make enough money to print it, done. So maybe the issue I'm coming up with is, this is the goal. Once the goal's hit, the project goes ahead, done. Nobody else can commit after that. Maybe this is an issue with Kickstarter in itself. You know, if you go onto Kickstarter and ask for £1,000 to print your book, and you get £1,000, that's it, you're done. That's what you ask for, that's what you get.
Yeah, but you can't churn off the Kickstarter then, and that's the problem. And, you know, it's like if you set your Kickstarter to run for 30 days because you're worried that it won't get funded, and it gets funded after like 10 days, you have these 20 days of community management ahead of you, and you know that people can also back out from their pledges until the project, you know, hits completion time. So you sort of have to keep up the hype, I think. And I guess that's what I meant earlier when I say that it's sort of the platform necessitates that. And I think also that the platform does something somewhat unkind to the people selling a product, is that if you buy as an individual a book in a store, you have no idea how many other copies are being sold anywhere else in the nation. Right. Whereas on Kickstarter, you see it all and you're like, oh my God, these people are making so much money, and all they're basically doing is, you know, they're putting up a second edition, or, you know, like, now I'm really going to get hate mail from everyone who sort of, because there is a lot of re-editions of stuff on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But now suddenly all your company funds are transparent. And I think the best Kickstarters are the ones that are really transparent, that are also saying, here, these are our expenses, this is where we're, you know. And it's like Henry mentioned, like, suddenly you have all this money and people are like, are you just going to get filthy rich of this? Which you would if you were just selling on Steam. Nobody's going to go, okay, Valve, you know, are they are they the worst company ever? And because they're getting filthy rich of Dota and in-game sales and whatever. And if it's out there, you have to sort of stand for it. And then
there's the expectation, isn't there? That it's not just a consumer. When you fund a project, you want to feel like you're part of it. You know, you're called a backer, aren't you? You're not called a customer. You're a backer.
Exactly. So
there's more of an engagement feeling. Whether or not that's true or not is something that I'm supposed to be debating right now. But there's the idea that you're a part of something that you're with everyone else. You know, you're with the crowd funding the project. It's in the name. So with that, it kind of comes this kind of same sense of expectation. And then when you see a company maybe just taking the profits that they've made and putting it in their pocket, that's going to give you a different feeling than if you had walked into a shop or gone on the Steam sale or whatever you might have done and pulled it off the shelf, because the expectation is different. We were also talking about buyer's remorse. Now, this is something that me and Jamie have discussed before. It's different with a crowdfund than it is in a shop. If I go into a shop and pick up an RPG book, let's say it hasn't got the best front cover, or I was fooled by the cover maybe, pick it up and bring it home and open it and see that it's actually not the best book in the world. It wasn't really what I was expecting. It wasn't what I hoped for when I left the shop. I'm like, oh, that's a bit of a disappointment, but I only brought it 10 minutes ago when I was in the shop. I'll put it in the shelf. Like, I know it was a bit of an impulse buy. Put it to one side. I don't really feel too bad. But if I crowdfund something and I spend £45 to get a backer level that's going to include me a little set of dice or whatever that takes my fancy, and then I wait a year and a half, and then I hear I'm following the backer updates and I'm following the emails and I'm on the hype train with everyone else in the crowd that I've chosen to be a part of with this developer or the publisher or whoever it is, and then a year and a half later the book arrives and it's a total piece of shit, the buyer's remorse is a lot higher than if I just walked into a shop and brought it and walked home. And I've kind of feel in a way, one kind of feels in a way that you have to defend that book a little bit more. Like, no, I invested a year and a half of my life waiting for this product, so I don't want to say it's really shit. I'm going to want to kind of be a little bit inclined to convince myself that it's good because of all this emotional investment that I've put into it. Isn't that right, Jamie? I know we were having this discussion earlier.
I agree. I think there's an inherent wish for people not to appear foolish. So even if they receive a product and they know it's not up to scratch, or they know it's not what they were offered, or they realize it's terrible, a lot of people will go out there and then publicly defend it rather than just say, you're absolutely right, this is terrible, because you're just admitting you've been had, basically. And I think that's part of the issue with Kickstarter. So,
yeah, which is not the case with something like moving 7.5 tons of metal across a country, which is such a pragmatic A to B thing. I really admire that. I think that's what crowdfunding really should be used for, is actually helping people to get things done in that kind of way.
And I think maybe Kickstarter doesn't actually have too many of these products, so they're projects, or they're like hidden behind, you know. I think that's also what Jamie is sort of mostly about, is that it's unfinished products that will be done in some years that you can buy now. And that's like a really boring Etsy of, you know, like future books or something.
Okay, so I'm gonna drag us back to art.
Please do.
Or at least production, an art production and kind of RPG design physically. And I know it might seem a weird question, and maybe it's not important at all, but I'm going to throw it out there and see what you guys think about it. Because some people will be collectors and love to put their books on a shelf, and some people will be, you know, people who just get PDFs and, you know, put them into a digital file somewhere and just enjoy reading the book, and that's it. But for me, as somebody who enjoys a physical product, I'm wondering what you guys think about books that are not in what I would call a regular format. So obviously RPGs have a regular size, a regular height, and, you know, kind of dimension. But we often get these books that are maybe landscape or A6 or, you know, A3 or, you know, and I can't pull any off the, well, there's a few, but I don't know. What do you think, Patrick, about books that do not fit that regular RPG format? Do you find those exciting, or do you think they're annoying?
I'm trying to come up with one. Like, I think the only one I can, from the top of my head, remember is Mouse Guard RPG, which, yes, I think is a smaller format. Like, and I guess that makes perfect sense because it's from the cartoon, from the comic. So it would obviously be like a comic book.
There's a company, and I may be mispronouncing them, so apologize if I do, Arcadia Press, who were printing a lot of interesting comic books in the early 2000s, were printing Mouse Guard in this lovely hardback, almost landscape format, so that when Mouse Guard, the role-playing game, came out, they just cloned the format of the graphic novel straight into the role-playing game.
Yeah, because then you just stack it next to your collection of Mouse Guard books. I honestly can't remember any other system like this. Like,
Well, it's really interesting you mentioned the Mouse Guard one, because that first edition of that hardback role-playing game actually goes for quite a lot of money now in the secondary market value. So if you're listening to this, and you have a copy, dig it out, you know, put the ISBN number into Amazon and be astounded by how much people want for it. And it went through a few other editions. It went to like a boxed edition, etc. But actually, it's a beautiful game. Mechanics-wise, it runs off the Burning Wheel engine, which is, you know, the Burning Wheel and Burning Empires, etc. So it's quite a simplistic but elegant mechanical system, which lends itself well to this kind of Red Wall style of role-playing. That I think is a perfect case in point, because the role-playing game came out of a product that was originally in the graphic medium. But you've got loads of other weird format games. You've got the second edition of Borgstrom's Nobilis was an absolutely huge coffee table book. Kefra's Hellas sci-fi Greek role-playing game was entirely landscape. Metamorphosis Alpha to Omega was landscape. There's just some off the top. It's really interesting when you get that A4 book, but the spine is on the short edge. Because I never, you know, do I stack that on my shelf spine down? Do I stack it spine up? Do I stack it sideways? These are the things that us collectors have to worry about.
The practical applications can get a bit frustrating. I know there's a DCC book that's just enormous. It's like an anvil or something. It's just massively thick and heavy. I've got a book here called Vagabonds of Dyfed, and that's a square hardback, which was quirky, and I enjoy it. It's pretty cool to hold. You're like, oh, you don't hold many square books, so that's interesting. But I think
Henry, are you familiar with Beneath the Inverted Church?
I am. I've got it on my shelf
here.
Yes,
that's a square too, isn't it? That's a square book,
more or less. Yeah. I think it gets to a point where you're tweaking the original format because you want the experience of reading the book to tie into the experience of absorbing the game. So it goes hand in hand with the format on the inside. And is it a hardback or a softback? Is it glossy or matte? What shape is it? How does it feel in your hands? I think you're getting into that kind of tactile territory there when you talk about the different shapes and sizes. You know, if it's an A4 book with the bind on the short side, you've now got every reader thinking about how they're going to hold it and put it on their shelves, like you've been talking about. So it adds that kind of extra element, whether or not it's a good thing or not, I'm not sure.
What I have noticed from having used a few of these landscape format RPGs, A4 RPGs in games, that I must defend them because they stay open perfectly. Whereas in play, when you've got one laid down in front of you, with especially a large, heavy page count RPG, it's very difficult to keep the page open. Whereas with a landscape book, gravity does all that work for you, and it stays open perfectly, whatever page you kind of flick to. So, from a logistical point of view, these landscape books can be quite interesting, but they're very rare in RPGs.
I'll make a note of that. I know what my next project is going to be.
So Jamie, I'm just thinking, because I sort of, I'm quite close to printing books with my students. I mean, it's an art school, so we're not actually publishing stuff, but we're making handmade books, and that involves or includes suing them, you know, suing the products mm-hmm. together and binding them. Why are so many books produced so incredibly poorly and badly? I think it's awful, actually. When we're talking about them also as collector's items, you know, and they're beautiful art, but some of them are done so bad.
I couldn't agree more. And I have a bugbear, a personal bugbear with... all right, okay. I'm going to take you on a journey, right? I'm going to tell you a little story.
Oh, I love these journeys.
So I'm running a comic book store back in around 2004. For those UK listeners, it's Travelling Man. And the Travelling Man in Newcastle had just opened, and I applied for the job, and I got the job as the first manager there, and I ran that store for quite a few years. Now, during my stint as manager at Travelling Man in Newcastle, Mongoose Publishing had acquired the rights to print and distribute role-playing games based on Michael Moorcock's Hawkmoon novels. Previously, obviously, Elric and various other characters had been printed by Chaosium. Change of license had moved over, and Mongoose were buying up intellectual properties left, right, and center at this time. And being a big fan of Michael Moorcock and a big fan of Elric and Hawkmoon and all these kind of things, when Mongoose was releasing those, I ordered reasonably high on them in order to get them into the shelf. Now, we're talking about, this drags me back to Patrick's point about binding. The physical production of these books, all of them were terrible. I mean, the binding was awful. The books wouldn't even open fully, and if they did, the spine would crack. They weren't like, you know, they were awful. And then the hardcovers they must have just been some sort of like mulched paper, because they were warped, and the books were really terrible. And I was on the phone to our distributor, which is SDVM Games, who actually are excellent games distributor, brilliant staff, you know, brilliant company. So I had rang our kind of the guy who looks after the store and said, you know, these books are a bit shit. Like, what can we do? Can we get these sent back, kind of thing? And he was like, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. You know, like, yeah, if there's a problem with the product, then obviously get it back to us and we'll sort it out for you, which was typical of their customer service. And this is the distributor. So anyway, I'm doing my day-to-day job, and I'm stacking comics on a shelf one day. And this guy walks up to me out of nowhere and says, are you the manager? And I says, yes. And he said, right, I write for Mongoose. And I've heard you telling everyone that our books are shit. And I was like, this guy caught me off guard, right? And I was like, I didn't tell anyone your books were shit. I was like, I had an issue with certain copies that I received that weren't in great condition. And I had to like, I didn't want to tell this guy who writes for Mongoose that all of the books were shit, because then I'm going to get the store in trouble. I'm going to get myself in trouble. So I'm basically having to say like, no, I had issue with a couple of products that I received. I don't know if they're the kind of representative of the line as a whole. Now, don't get me wrong, I later found out that actually it was absolutely representative of the line as a whole. I have had dozens of those books through my hands over the years, and the binding and the production quality is terrible, absolutely awful. And this guy totally cornered me, and I kind of had to like avoid him at one point. And I actually had to walk away from him, because I was like, I've got to go and do some stuff downstairs. You know, like I didn't want a confrontation with him, because I was happy to, as an individual, tell him the books were shit. But as the representative of a company, that's really difficult, because I didn't want to get my big boss in trouble and all this kind of stuff, and the distributor in trouble. So I was like, I was really caught in a weird place. But that changed my, not him, because that guy I'm sure was lovely. And actually later on I discovered that guy is, you know, a nice guy. And obviously he just sends the words out. He's not representative of the quality of the books that get printed. And I realized over time that he was probably more interested if they were shit, than that's doing his work a disservice. But that really changed my mind about Mongoose's publishing, because they had such a good license and they published something in such a terrible format that it disappeared. And I mean, now those books change hands for very little, because most of them have probably fallen apart. So that they have no kind of value as a physical product. Was it's a shame, because the writing inside of them is quite good. And I think that this really drags us back to this art idea, that actually if a book is poorly published and poorly represented physically, then it almost doesn't matter how good the content is, you're setting itself up for failure from the onset.
It's one half of the same product, isn't it, really? So is it cost-saving measures? Is it just they had a bad run of luck? Is it something that they went forward purposefully to do? Like, this gentleman must have held the book in his own hand, compared it to other books, and seen for himself.
You don't know. I mean, you would assume so, wouldn't you? But, you don't know whether writers are receiving kind of proof copies or you know, new copies or copies at all. I mean, I've spoken to writers who have worked for some of the bigger companies who don't even get free copies of the books that they've written. So I don't really know what he had in his hands. But what I do know is that Mongoose at the time had spread themselves so thin, getting licenses to things like Hawkmoon, Judge Dredd, Strontium Dog, loads of different things, Starship Troopers, all sorts of big licenses that were probably reasonably expensive. And I think they spent all their money on that, and they had no money left to produce a really serious physical product. And especially from a collector's point of view, where I can judge a game from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the solid physical product is really important, because I want to know that that book is going to stand the test of time. And when I'm purchasing books, etc., I can look at big collections and go, well, that collection is going to be worth nothing because I know the binding on those is terrible, I know the hardbacks are terrible, I know whatever. Whereas you've got companies like Wizards of the Coast, you can flick through one of their hardback 3.5 edition rule books, and those bad boys will stand the test of time. They will really, you know, they're good, solid books with solid binding and solid hardbacks and good glossy pages. So it goes to show, when you spend a lot of money on production, that those books will last a long time.
What you're saying is they should do a Kickstarter with stretch goals.
Will do actually good binding.
Not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. Not what I'm saying.
Do you prefer glossy pages?
I mean, I realize I probably come across quite, you know, really, really specific and, you know, picky with production and everything. And I am to a degree, because I am a collector. But actually, when it comes to glossy pages or none, I don't mind. I think as long as the binding's more important than the page quality, if I'm honest, because if you have beautiful pages, it doesn't matter if they come loose, you know. And there was huge issues with a lot of role-playing games in the kind of very late 90s, early 2000s had this habit of putting a selection of full-color glossy plates either at the beginning or the middle of a book. And I'm specifically referencing things like Leading Edge did Lawnmower Man and Bram Stoker's Dracula and Aliens. And Artal Saurian did a role-playing game based on the Bubblegum Crisis animation. And every time
it as well.
Yeah, and then every time you pick up these books, the pages that are loose are inevitably the color pages, because they're heavier, they're not bound in as well, and they will just become loose from the book, and the rest of it will remain, but it totally damages the value and the whole kind of solid feel of that book. And it's such a shame, and I would rather they just did 300 pages of black and white if that's what they're going to do, because then the book would stay together. So yeah, I think that's a real shame.
Because I had a feeling when I was picking up a lot of German language Shadowrun that they had like a non-glossy. I might be mistaken, because I don't have these books anymore to verify, but I always thought that it was nice and tactile in the way that it felt more like, you know, novel book paper, but thick enough that you can't see the, you know, it's like it was proper, but it wasn't glossy. And I thought it was actually quite nice.
I must confess, I think the Shadowrun, all of the Farsa books were really well produced, actually. It's very rare to get a book produced by Farsa from that time period that doesn't stand up well, unless it's been really, really well loved and well played. In which case, of course, that, you know, a book can only withstand so much traveling and flicking and pizza stains and coffee and beer and things like that. So, but yeah, the early Shadowrun books are actually pretty good.
Yeah, Fassa was good for that kind of thing. Their bulky, glued spines really kind of held together, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Do you I don't know what it was like in Europe, but in Britain, we didn't get many of the, I'm going to refer to it as a paperback format. So you remember the old corgi paperbacks? So like a genuine small format paperback novel. You used to get role-playing games that were like that. Not many, but Dragon Warriors and Maelstrom, and the kind of almost like that fighting fantasy, choose your own adventure style books. You used to get full RPGs like that.
I think I only had these ones where you're like, you know, play by the numbers and you go to like, you know, event 47 and then you're dead or something like this. I never picked up any of those. I don't know about that.
But then I wonder why in the modern day, especially with this real focus on returning to early kind of gaming roots, why we don't see many games published in that very easy to transport format, where you could literally stick one of these paperbacks in your back pocket or your jeans, you could throw it into a bag. You know, there was nothing worse when I was younger, running a game of, I don't know, Vampire Dark Ages and carrying six or seven large, heavy A4 books around because you felt you had to, you know, and you know, you kind of wanted to show off as well. Of course you did. But, you know, throwing a paperback into your pocket or anything is, I mean, maybe we don't need that now because you can put everything on a, you know, a memory stick or whatever.
Isn't it the same with, I'm sorry to interrupt you, isn't it the same with like newspapers? Like, there is like a whole kind of, there's lectures about this and all, but I think when you look at newspapers, why the hell are newspapers so large? And I think, you know, this is like, it's me half making this up and half sort of remembering something that I once dreamt of that I think is probably real, but so this is the perfect content for a podcast.
This is the human energy field, baby. This is what it's all about.
There you go, right?
Dream some stuff up and talk about it. That's what we're here for.
All right. So I have this vision. I have this dream that at some point, like a format of newspapers was by page count was, you know, there's some rule, some reason for why it would be cheaper to print these really big sheets, these big sheets, and sort of fold them, because then you realize like newspapers, they're really not pleasant to maneuver. Like they're so big, you have to like fold them open. It's awkward. And it's like you already get the newspaper like triple folded. It's like folded in the middle and it's like folded around. And so, and after what, like, and then it sort of, it takes a long time for people to question this, because, you know, you just know that this is how a newspaper looks like, which is, I think, why you kind of know that if you want to sell a really, you know, a proper RPG, it better be hardcover, it better be A4, and it better have a page count around 300.
Yeah, well,
you know,
yeah.
Which is, I think, the kind of stuff like that.
So doesn't the quite modern movement of kind of OSR, post lamentations, heavy art style, low mechanics games, don't they fly in the face of that idea?
Like Engel, you mean, for instance? Is maybe, Engel a low mechanic game?
Or yeah, I'm thinking more of things like Morkborg.
Oh yeah, okay, I get it. Yes.
I mean, they're very stylized. They tend not to be in that traditional A4 hardback format, you know, and I think I call them post Lamentations games because I think Lamentations really set the bar for that format and that kind of style of, you know, low mechanics, heavy art, heavy style. Almost they're grindhouse, aren't they? I mean, by their own definition, they're grindhouse. That's what they call themselves.
With Sun-O or something right now, right? They're doing some weird sort of...
Yeah, they got Greg Anderson to join the vinyl soundtrack for Morkborg. So, I mean, I was expecting us to talk about Morkborg at some point in this episode. I don't own it. I wish I could afford to buy into it. That sounds really cool. But they've got Greg Anderson coming on the vinyl. So that's pretty exciting, Patrick, to be honest. I'm looking forward to that because I'm a big fan of Sun.
Yeah, but I interrupted Jamie, so that was rude.
No, please do, because I'm interested to hear what you guys are saying about this.
Well, I just heard the Dungeon Punk guy talk about it, Mark. I also listened to an episode where this was featured. I'm not entirely sure if I'm mixing this up, but I actually, you know, despite having lived in Sweden the last years, I sort of missed that game too, because I'm not really following the scene anymore, or you know, never have. I think it looks super cool, but it also looks not actually like a game that I'm interested in terms of world building or like, you know, deeper mechanics. It looks like something stylish, and you know, you just want to put on like a soundtrack and, you know, have fun, and you're like a lost soul. It's like a video game, sort of.
Yeah. I agree, mate. It passed me by too, and I think it's because of the reasons that you've listed. it's sort of, you know, I come up, I was like, oh, that, well, that looks cool. But then I looked at it and it looked cool. And then I just carried on with my life. I wasn't really compelled to actually go and seek it out and play it. It was just more of a visual thing. So I don't know if anyone has played, if you're listening to this and you have played Morkborg and you have some thoughts, let us know. At the end of the episode, we'll put some details in how you can get in contact with us, because I'd like to hear from someone who's played it. I'm sure there are a lot of fans of it, you know, so we'll see. I don't know what Morkborg is like, but who knows? It's definitely arty. It's definitely got an art direction of its own, hasn't it?
It looks super cool.
I think part of the success of these super highly stylized OSR productions are either consciously or unconsciously riding off the back of the success of D&D 5th edition, because I think when D&D have done such a good job of getting their, what is arguably the greatest role-playing game ever, out back into the mainstream and, you know, back out into the public consciousness, it allowed these individual creators to come along and produce something which can easily be adopted by people who have read, you know, the introduction to D&D online, or picked up a player's handbook, or played the introductory box set or whatever. Automatically you already have a customer base to jump onto, whereas I think that was really difficult up until recent years. I mean, recent years as in, like, you know, kind of 10 years ago, and when Pathfinder was in charge, because I don't think you would have had this Lamentation style indie Morkborg kind of esque vibe being quite as strong bouncing off Pathfinder 3.5 edition, which is very mechanics heavy. And I realize that these new productions are flying in the face of that, and they're saying story is more important than mechanics, and feel and vibe is more important than mechanics, which is not something new. I mean, Artal Sorian in Cyberpunk 2020 told us this a long time ago. And, you know, as I keep mentioning Lamentations, but I just think it's so important for this discussion about, you know, the art direction. They were pushing it really before D&D 5th was really big. So, you know, James Raggi was well ahead of his time. And I think people may claim that they're not kind of jumping on that bandwagon, but I think credit where credit's due. You know, he was a real trailblazer for this kind of product.
I think, like it or not, Kickstarter has kind of changed the face of the industry a little bit, and it's definitely broadened out in ways that it hadn't done, let's say, 10 years ago when everyone was playing Pathfinder instead of 4E. You know, it's taken it in new directions, because you're able to have these developers without any support from bigger companies getting their products out there. And whether or not you agree with the format at all, it's happened, and it still happens now. And it has kind of enabled this branching out and this development of styles across countries that might not have happened before. You know,
I don't think, I agree with you. I do. And you know, I don't take any issue with what you've just said. I think talking about Kickstarter is yeah, thanks for a change. but I think talking about Kickstarter and, you know, RPGs and Kickstarter deeper than this, and how it's affected the RPG industry is a conversation for another time. I do, however, think that there is a lot of shit that is released because of Kickstarter that wouldn't have been released if the people had to get off their asses and actually raise the money and have the balls to put the book on the shelf. Because what you've got to remember is the RPG industry, it was built on companies and even individual designers having the balls to back their product and to print it and put it on the shelf and sell it before any money was made. You know, all of the money had to go in up front. And I know Kickstarter turns that around, and everything I've said before, I realize it can do good things, but I think it's also allowed a huge amount of dross to plug the market.
Well, it's the same with films, isn't it? They don't make films like they used to anymore either.
Yeah, but
go ahead, Patrick.
After you've sort of said all this, like I kind of have to step in and say the exact opposite about it too. That, you know, that it's sort of, because for instance, I was thinking the other day, like how is it that I'm playing RPGs again? I mean, yes, it's the lockdown, and you know that, you know, you're clawing at your door at home, and you're just wondering, like, how do I, you know, what did I do before to not get mad, nuts. But I realized that actually it was at art school in Stockholm at like a winter fair that I realized that a lot of tables had like fifth edition sort of spin-off content on it. Like people had like sketches for characters. You could like for Fiverr get like your character drawn. And a lot of it was extremely queer friendly. It was super inclusive. It was like there was like small zines that were people were publishing where they were kind of, you know, making a claim for the better treatment of orcs, you know, that you know, like they have feelings and like all this stuff. And I thought it was really good. It was really amazing to realize that, okay, this has put a lot of power into people's hands. Maybe, you know, like with everything good, it gets eaten by the bad company right away because they're like, okay, that's the new thing that works. Good, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna rainbow color all our products, and there we go. You know, like, as it, okay, great. Like, that's your contribution to Pride. Wonderful.
Yeah.
But I thought it was, for me, this was amazing. And I guess that also comes back to sort of a small few that go out on Kickstarter and do something quite great, you know. And even if it's only one RPG where that uses they instead of he or she, as simple as that. I guess.
Yeah, and you might have people writing these things, and the only way they know to get it out is Kickstarter. They haven't heard of another way to get their product out right there. But then, you know, they know they can connect with people. They've heard of this thing where you can crowdfund projects, and they don't know any better. So, you know, in some cases, it might be the only way for them to actually make any sort of progress. So you're right. There's a lot of different ways we can look at this, certainly. Do you guys have any closing thoughts about this kind of amalgamation of conversations we've been having for the past hour and a bit? Do you have any kind of finishing statements, anything you want to say?
A whole list of books we still need to talk about before we can end this. No, I'd really sort of, I don't know, I'd like to sort of name drop something like Engel, which I think is amazing.
Do you want to tell our listeners what this game is then? Give us a brief
spell that for me as well, please.
I don't know. In retrospect, I feel I've already botched my short rundown of Overlight so very bad that I don't know if I should. Engel is just, it's a game that with a really tight art design. It has like, I think it's got two illustrators, something that did the main work. It's post-apocalyptic. You play as angels. I don't want to give away too many other mechanizations of the world. The book is beautiful back to front. It's got like a couple of source books that are beautiful. It's got a couple of German novels that have the same sort of illustration style but done by another German illustrator. It's just really beautiful setting, like pure eye candy. So beautiful.
The game in English, for obviously a lot of people listening, obviously be listening in English. It was published by White Wolf, I believe, as part of their fantasy imprint. But under the art house of Federn, am I pronouncing this right? Federn Schwarz?
Federn Schwert.
Yeah. Federn Schwert. The English translation only received 4 publications. The main rulebook, which was a standalone D&D 3.5 product, which used the OGL system. There was a order book, Michaelites, Book of the Dream Seed, and a very small graphic novel called The Pandoramicon. That's all that got released in English. And as you've just said, post-apocalyptic kind of angel fantasy game. It would appeal to fans of things like Dying Earth and Gene Wolfe's Shadow of the Torturer and you know, D&D in general. Absolutely beautiful books. The bestiary, the Creatures of the Dream Seed, is probably one of my favorite creature books, one of my favorite monster books, and the art is absolutely unreal. Very dark, very realistic. Absolutely amazing. So yeah, that's a great shout. I mean, you know, we're on an episode talking about art. That is such an artistic book. It's brilliant, fantastic.
How about you, Henry? Do you have any things that you want in this conversation?
I mean,
or do you want to sideline it a bit more?
This is the problem that we face a lot: is that we end up having so much to talk about. We have to make sure that we fit it into a certain kind of format. I've got enough notes here for another hour or two of conversation, so we do have to narrow it down. That's the problem that me and Jamie end up facing a lot of the time. We've got to stick to the
format. Maybe we'll do an art volume 2 Electric Boogaloo in the new year. Do you know what I mean? We'll come back to it, you know.
Yes.
We're gonna have to.
Nice.
Honourable mentions. David Gallagher, The Inquisitor Rulebook.
Wow.
I just think he's perfect. Follow him on Instagram as well, guys. David Gallagher's Instagram account is great. Also, John Blanche, Ralph Bakshi. And I did want to mention, because I was going through my notes and I've been listening to this episode while we've been talking about it. I've been listening to you guys talk about your favourite artists, and we haven't mentioned any women yet. So I would like to give a shout out to an artist called Phoebe Herring, who is a artist that I found on Instagram. And she does digital paintings of like her Dark Heresy games that she's in, and some 40K stuff. And she also does digital paintings of Half-Life 1 characters and this kind of thing. She's really, really talented. I think she lives down in Cornwall somewhere, or she's at least British somehow. So I just wanted to mention Phoebe Herring, guys. Check out her Instagram if you can. She's really good.
To back that up, Henry, I'll also mention a very, very amazing female artist, Rebecca. I'm gonna butcher her surname. Guy or Gay? It's spelled G-U-A-Y. I'm sorry if I don't know how to pronounce that, Gway or Gay or Guy. Rebecca Guy, G-U-A-Y. She's done a lot of work for RPG. She's done a lot of work for Magic the Gathering, for people who play that. Her artwork is absolutely fantastic. She actually did some artwork for Changeling, which we mentioned at the start of the episode. So definitely go on. She's heavily active on Instagram as well. And her modern stuff is very thought-provoking, very, very political and very kind of, it's absolutely amazing. So check her out on Instagram as well, because she's an amazing artist.
Awesome. So this is all going to go in the show notes. Our recommendations of people, definitely.
Yeah, we'll put links to the Instagram accounts and et cetera of those people that we've mentioned, so you can check them out.
This is a male dominated industry, and I do want to kind of do my part to negate that somewhat. So I'm hoping we'll try and tip the balance a little bit more as we go into the future, and hopefully try and even the scales out as much as we can. Do you know what I mean?
Again, a subject for another time.
Yes. So with that in mind, we're going to... I know we talked about art and crowdfunding and a lot of other things, so thank you if you stuck around for that meandering conversation. I enjoyed it. I'm sure Jamie and Patrick did as well. Now, we want to move on from this segment into our kind of usual segments that we do. We have music and a movie. Now, I don't know about you guys, especially Jamie, I would like to do the movie, because I can't wait to hear your thoughts about this, and then we can end with a shorter section about the album that I've picked for this episode. So should we talk about the movie now, Jamie? I'm going to hand over to you.
Okay, we can do that. Are you going to stay with us, Patrick, for this section?
I think I'm going to head on, actually.
That's absolutely fine.
If you don't mind. I'm going to catch up with you guys later. But I've been sitting in front of Zoom meetings all day. So
we massively appreciate you spending the time you did with us tonight after you've been at work today.
Yeah, so thank you very much for having me.
Come back on as well in the new year, and we'll discuss art some more or various other things.
Yeah, I'd love to. Because the list is still valid, so there's a couple of more
keep
names
that list. Oh, yeah, definitely
to rattle
not.
Off and things to talk about. Yeah, it's been great fun. Thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to hearing later what your movie and song picks were.
Appreciate that, man. Well, don't watch the film, because it's not worth watching, but we'll get to that in a second.
Shots fired.
Have shots fired. Nice. Good night, mate. All right.
Okay, good night. Bye-bye. Soon.
Good night, Barry.
All right, Jamie, I'm going to hand over to you, mate. This is on you now. Let's do the movie.
All right, okay. So, Patrick's gone now, so I wanted to say thank you very much for Patrick for coming on. Really appreciated that. Time flew over, and I just thought I'd give him the opportunity to bow out there, because I know the guy personally, and he's been in big meetings today. So I don't blame him for bowing out with this. All right, so we move on to our the movie segment of the show, where we're going to talk about something. We take turns in bringing a movie into the arena and discussing it. So my choice was the 2014 movie Vampire Nation. for those of you who at the time of recording, you can go out and check it out on Prime, or I'm sure it's available in other places. So Vampire Nation, it is a hour and a half long movie set in the modern day. I want to put it out there first, as fans of True Blood and Vampire Diaries and the originals, etc., will find much to like about this movie. It has that same kind of approach to filmmaking, same approach to characterization. It doesn't take itself massively seriously, but I think it stops itself from moving into farce. We are presented with a world where vampires have revealed themselves to mankind and are existing in a kind of symbiotic relationship. However, due to their limited numbers, or so we think, they are being herded into kind of reservations or camps, or certain areas, and their populations are controlled. The movie follows a group of adventurers, and it is a group of adventurers. It's a party of various people who have to go in and solve a mystery of what's happening to the vampires in Romania, and drama and combat ensues until we reach a happy ending. So that's the overview of it. It's a modern day movie with vampires. I think it turns itself on its head because vampires have revealed themselves to humans. But before I go on any further about it, you've just watched it, Henry, so tell me what you think about it.
Okay, look, I wouldn't expect you to pull any punches with films that I've chosen, right? So agreed. I'm not going to... Okay, all right, okay, good to know. When you text me and said your film choice is Vampire Nation, I rolled my eyes. And when I turned it on, and then I got 20 seconds in, and the very first thing that happened made me roll my eyes again. And I thought, oh, this is going to be it, is it? And then that was it. My kind of burning question, it's a film where a group of adventurers, humans, have to team up with vampires to create a crack team that go into the underbelly of a dark city to hunt other more mutated vampires and stop them from taking over everything that's happening. So why did you pick this over Blade 2?
All right, okay. So a couple of reasons. Blade 2 is terrible. Blade 1 is great. So the Blade movies get progressively worse as we go on. And I actually think that Vampire Nation sits in the same pigeonhole as movies like Blade 2 and of the TV shows that I previously mentioned. So for people who enjoy a little bit of True Blood or a little bit of Vampire Diaries and whatever, but want a few more like, cool shots of guys walking into rooms with two revolvers held out and, kind of quippy one-liners and, it doesn't take itself too seriously. It's not going to win any awards, but is it not entertaining at the end of it? Yes, I think it is, because the story is fairly interesting. Yes, it can be read. And the characters are very archetypal. I mean, you have a lawgiver, a policeman, you have a vampire hunter who's just come out of prison, you have his sister, you have the guys have to work together. I think to me, the reason that I brought it to the table is it presents a great example of how a movie can be turned into a role-playing session. Now, to me, this movie is a perfect setup for an adventure. You could watch this movie safe in the knowledge that your players probably haven't watched it and present the adventure as written on screen and the twists and turns. I think there's enough twists and turns in it to keep it going. So, for instance, the example is a group of mortal vampire hunters have to team up with some vampires in order to solve the mystery of why some vampires are being attacked by this mystery virus.
Blade 2.
The twists and turns that follow this would be great twists and turns for a role-playing game. Simple enough for player characters to figure out and have some fun, but complicated enough that it's not obvious at the beginning. The guy who you think is you know, dodgy at the beginning is dodgy. You know, we've got this British actor who plays the a figure who is the kind of Judas of the group. And do you know what he reminds me of? He reminds me of like a 2-bit Burke from Aliens. I mean, that's what he reminds me of.
I don't think it was a good writer's decision to combine the Judas character with the comic relief character into that one English person. That didn't work for me at all. Give me two separate comic relief. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Perhaps not. But I just think you've got a few bits of setup here. You've got, and especially for fans of Vampire the Masquerade, you've got some little moments in this movie that are worth watching. You've got an embrace scene near the end where, you know, a human character is going to die, and the only way to save them is for the vampire to take them into that other world. You know, turn them into a vampire. And only a few minutes are spent on this, and there's not a great amount of dramatic pathos, I admit. But it's a great setup. But I've used, and I'll admit, I have used that dramatic technique in more than one game. Doing a mortal, loads of damage, and then forcing the player characters into making a quick decision about whether that character should be turned into a vampire or not is an age-old storytelling technique for Vampire the Masquerade referees. And if you don't use it, learn it, put it in your repertoire. You should definitely use it in games because when used right, it can be absolutely fantastic.
And probably better than this film does it, to be honest.
I think if you're going to judge this film alongside and compare it to things like Near Dark or Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire, it's going to fail on every conceivable level. I agree with you.
Okay.
But it doesn't. I'm not trying to give it that amount of acclaim. I'm saying, is it an interesting story that deals with an interesting concept? And when you look behind the kind of shoddy acting and the dodgy delivered one-liners, what you get is an interesting scenario. So you've got vampires and humans living side by side, which on screen hasn't been done a lot, to be fair. And I know you keep mentioning the Blade 2, and that's one of the main differences. You've got these few little mentions of a greater world out there where vampires are. There's a vampire-human embassy. I mean, that in itself, from a storytelling role-playing point of view, throws up loads of really interesting discussion points. You know, when do the meetings take place, and like where do the meetings take place, and you know, how if you have to go to the embassy and somebody's through the day, do you have prison cells that are blocked off from the light, and all these interesting things. And you almost have, I think, Vampire Nation has this approach to vampires and humans that you get from, do you remember the Will Smith Netflix original Bright?
Yes, I do remember that film, yeah.
Okay, so remember the way the orcs are treated, clearly as a thinly veiled version of kind of black-white society in America?
Yeah.
I think Vampire Nation does this with the vampires and the humans in a less heavy-handed way, because the film is very less heavy-handed. It's much shallower. Which I admit, but it does present vampires as a potential underclass. So you have this tiny little throwaway character who is the policeman's garbage guy. He collects the trash, and they have this little interplay at the beginning of the movie, and it actually turns out the vampire helps him at the end, which is this really kind of cool way of saying, you know, not all vampires are bad. And I realize it's done in a very kind of childish Saturday morning TV way. But it presents this idea that there are two classes here, and the vampires are actually the underclass, and the powers that be are trying to destroy the underclass. So in a way, Vampire Nation is almost making a racial or kind of class statement with the way it delivers it, which something like Blade 2 wouldn't do.
Okay. I think social commentary is kind of baked into a lot of vampire tales anyway, because you're bound to have some kind of difference between what are essentially races or species, I imagine. So there's going to be some social commentary in there. I did like that it was set in Romania. I did not like that they called the protagonist Harker after Jonathan Harker and then didn't include Dracula at the end. Like, at least have the balls to put fucking Dracula in. If it's set in Romania and you've called your protagonist Harker, put Dracula in the film.
Well,
they didn't even do that.
They did. I mean, if you look at the, there was a vampire main character who was of the Order of Dracul, who was one of one of Vlad Tepes' children, and he'd been around for 600 years. So, I mean, they were making kind of reference to that original kind of vampire thing. But I actually think if they made Jonathan Harger, if they outright said, you are the great-great-great-great-great-grandson of, you know, Mina Harger or whatever, then actually I think that would have added more farce to the story rather than more credence.
I mean, that actor, to me, he had negative screen presence. Like, every time he appeared, I turned away from the screen. That's how...
A lot of the major characters were very two-dimensional. I'm not going to argue with that at all. They had their set pieces, they had the things they were going to say, they delivered them pretty poorly. But to me, it's the story. I knew who the heroes and villains were. People who were presented as villains at the beginning became the heroes at the end, and vice versa. I think that's interesting. I think where I'm supporting it is, can I watch this as a storyteller of role-playing games and develop this storyline into a good game? Yes, I can. I think I can. I think there's understandable NPCs there. I think there's a great opportunity for PCs to be the human vampire hunters thrown into this situation. Can I imagine that being a great kind of adventure that would last, you know, maybe minimum four sessions, up to about 6-8 sessions? I think you could do that movie in, and I think it would be an interesting game.
I think I'm learning a lot about your film taste from doing these podcasts with you so far, mate. It's really interesting.
I just think, don't get me wrong, I am not defending this in its acting capabilities.
I wouldn't let you defend it.
No, I'm not. And do you know what? I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the acting is, it forces you to have a wry smile almost all the way through it. But what's interesting is, I genuinely believe the actors think they're doing a good job. So it never turns into a kind of self-propagated farce. There's none of this like kind of winking between the characters knowing they're doing a shit job. Inside of the internal logic of the film, they're all deadly serious. So you can watch it laughing at it as an outsider, but there's no laughing happening in the film. And I think that's what stops it becoming a parody rather than just a bad film. And it is a bad film, but it's not a parody. And I think that's what's massively different.
Yeah, okay. I'm relieved to hear you say those words that it's bad. But there is a difference between like a sort of like a black comedy or something that maybe even the director knows he's not taking himself seriously. The director's other films that he's done are quite similar to this B-movie-esque kind of approach.
And I'm in return that you've used the term B-movie, because I think if we call this a B-movie, then the audience and all of us can agree that we will always cut something that's a B-movie a little bit extra slack. You know, we aren't paying our $20 and, you know, going on the red carpet to watch this and assuming it's going to be amazing. It is a B-movie. It is a late night, the kind of thing you'll see on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's that kind of film. And this is why when I first introduced it, it will appeal to fans of things like The Vampire Diaries and True Blood, people who don't want to take their vampire fiction massively seriously. You know, and for those people who can just dig into their popcorn and watch these vampires fight each other and see these guys deliver some corny lines, I think it ticks those boxes perfectly.
Cool, man. And obviously you can translate it onto the gaming table, which is... it's funny how the story beats for an RPG game, and imagining this movie would be an RPG game, it's funny how those story beats are much more kind of simplified for players around a table than there might be in like a Oscar bait film or some kind of complex screenplay. Do you know what I mean? It's very simple. There's a film. It's very A to B throughout, isn't it?
Well, it is. But I think when you present your plot to a group of players around the table, you don't want to railroad them, but you want to give them enough clues that they find the next point of call. They move from A to B to C, or they might move from A to B to D to C, but eventually they will reach the end point. And I think there was enough in there to switch things backwards and forwards. For instance, you know, for people who will go out and watch this film and spend an hour and a half watching it, which I think, you know, if you've got an hour and a half spare and you work and you put it on, I think it's a fun little romp. And it does have all of the problems that you've highlighted, but if you were to present this as a scenario, I think it would keep your players guessing. There's enough there to go backwards and forwards, to go like, oh, well, this is what I thought that this kind of vampire virus was about, but actually it turns out this person's doing it. And yeah, people who've played a lot of role-playing games and read a lot of other Agatha Christie's will figure that out very quick. Of course they will. But for the average player around the table, I think that journey would be a fun one. And the end result isn't a surprise, but is a pleasure.
And it's better to imagine the vampires than watch that CGI.
Do you know what? I think he does a good job on the CGI, because actually I think he does a lot of it in darkness. A lot of it is in low focus. A lot of it is we really only see these kind of reduced vampires in one or two scenes near the end of the film. And I will agree with you that those scenes fall short.
Shocking.
Yeah, but I think for the rest of the movie, we have this almost this Starship Troopers 2, Aliens 2-esque vibe to do two sides of the pendulum. Where you are, you're not seeing the things straight on. You're seeing them in shadows and darkness, and there's a lot of gunfire, and there's a lot of people being upset and things like that. So I think it plays well into that, you know, and it hasn't been done on a huge budget. They've picked a nice little industrial part of Eastern Europe to set their story in. And I think for an hour and a half, there are worse ways to be entertained, especially if you enjoy that kind of popcorn vampire fiction. And that's what this is. It's vampire popcorn fiction.
Yeah, it's certainly popcorn fiction. Yeah, definitely. I've got two-thirds of the way in. I just wanted to see Dracula, man. I don't care about the Order of Dracula. I just wanted to see some Dracula. Why would you call your protagonist Jonathan Harker if you're not going to put Dracula in the film?
I think that's what's being called a nod without going into farce, isn't it? So,
I'll nod at that.
Well, I think we can wrap that up there anyway. I think people can go out there and enjoy it, knowing that they're not in for an award-winning movie. If they want to watch something kind of cool, people shooting at weird vampires, and you know, that's fine. If they want to get an inspiration for a World of Darkness story, or you know, a modern horror tale, then I think that's great. Because I think you're dodging part of the really interesting thing behind it, was the fact that vampires had revealed themselves to humanity, and there was the vampire embassy, and you know, how are the human nations going to resolve against that, and how does that work with policing and all that kind of stuff. And you know,
I found that the film kind of fell down on its own internal logic in that sense, because they're doing a bit of exposition near the start, talking about how vampires have only revealed themselves to humans in the past 10 years. And then like an hour later, one vampire says to a human, it all went wrong for us the last time we revealed ourselves to you. So that really confused me about what the actual lore of the film was. And then I just kind of stopped caring about it because I was too busy distracted by how bad the CGI was. So I don't know if I was just too busy being in pain to worry about the lore.
I know the moment you're mentioning, and I think it was I think that was maybe a little storyline that was cut in the edit sequence that maybe was just too long, and they just cut it all out, because there's a throwaway comment there that I think has more behind it, and we didn't see any of that. But I think for somebody who wants to develop that into a wider storyline, it's a great little hook or a little red herring or whatever. I think that's fine.
Yeah, can't fault it in that sense. You're right.
But anyway, I think we've pretty much said all we need to say about that one. Don't take it too seriously. If you want to watch an hour and a half of dudes shooting at vampires, then watch this. If you want to watch a, you know, classic vampire movie, I'm sure many of the more movies I'll bring to the table will scratch that itch for you.
Yeah, definitely. We've got plenty more movies coming up.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. We will finish off this episode quickly with our music segment. I have chosen Conan with their 2010 EP Horseback Battlehammer. Now, there are a couple of reasons that I chose this release for my turn on the music segment. First of all, knowing that it was a art episode, I thought to myself, what bands do I like that have good artwork on the front covers? Good iconic pieces of art. And one of the first bands that came to my mind was Conan. Another criteria that I set myself was that it had to be something heavy metal, because this is a podcast that I am on and I won't let it get any further without playing a heavy metal song. So Conan have had quite a few releases. They're still going strong. This EP was from 2010, so it was quite a while ago. Although they did reissue it a few years ago, I think. There was a reissue on Napalm Records. It's only a 30-minute EP. Conan, if you've heard them before, are you familiar with the band, Jamie?
I was just about to say, for the purposes of me and for anyone else listening, is this English outfit American or European? Or
they are a three-piece doom metal band from Liverpool.
Ah, right, okay.
Liverpool's got a good metal scene, man. There's a lot of other good bands up there as well, bands like Black Magician and Corrupt Moral Altar. But Conan really kind of spearhead this doom movement coming out of the UK, in the same vein as bands like Sleep have been doing for decades already. And they had a great split with Bong Ripper. That's a really good record, so check that out. The sound as a whole is kind of really distorted and down-tuned, and they've got this big colossal kind of wall of sound going on. I just think the artwork is really evocative, which is kind of what led me towards this EP, to be honest. It's my favourite of their releases. The cover is this knight on horseback, and he's shot full of arrows. He looks really weary. He's really tired. His horse just looks knackered. And there is a pale rider that's like next to him. And it's this gowned Grim Reaper. And the Grim Reaper's like staring at this knight with this evil smile. And the Grim Reaper is riding a horse. And this dead horse is teasing the knight's horse at the same time. It's kind of like this dying knight is being taunted by death. It's really evocative. This artwork was done by a gentleman called Tony Roberts, who does all of Conan's art. They've got a lot of great merch as well. I've got stacks full of Conan merch in my wardrobe. I just find that every release they put out, I'm excited to see what new Tony Roberts artwork is going to come out with the music. You know, it's almost like a part of the whole at this point with Conan.
Have you seen them live at all?
I have seen them live. I saw them in Digbeth a few years ago with a few friends. And I saw them once in Angel down in London as well. So I've seen them twice live.
Do you want to give us some insights into the live performance?
I quit smoking for about 6 years, and then I went to see Conan, and then it made me want to have a cigarette. So basically,
I don't know how that sits in the review thing. Is that good or bad? Not being a smoker myself, I don't know if that's good or bad or what.
I was crushed by a wall of sound, and I had to recover, and I needed some nicotine to recover from that. I took my friends to see them in Birmingham, and their music critics, I will actually love to get Neil on at some point. You'll know Neil.
Talk
about music with us, because he'll have a lot to say. But I took Neil and our friend Jim with us to go and see them, and they'd never really listened to much Conan or heard them before. And I think Neil came out with PTSD afterwards. Like, he just was not expecting his brain to be crushed by the riffs. Honestly, they're probably the heaviest band I've seen, bar Primitive Man, who are also very fucking heavy. But Conan have got this stage presence, and the way they set up their rig and the lyrics of the songs, I mean obviously the band is called Conan, right? So a lot of the songs they write are about things like fighting giants in swamps, or you know, they've got a song off their latest release called Vault Thrower.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of fantasy callbacks and small little references and stuff. Well, they're not outwardly like power fantasy like Led Zeppelin 1 or anything like that, but there's definitely, it's three nerdy guys playing heavy music, if you like. I think that's a good way to describe them.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
They've defined their own sound as Caveman Battle Doom. is the genre they're putting for themselves.
Wow.
I mean, they're a great band. They're one of my favourite acts. I would recommend going to see them live whenever that becomes an option for people ever again, if it does. Because the two times I've seen them have been really memorable gigs. The Basement in Angel, I can't believe it ever happened now, looking back on how COVID has changed the industry, because it was, you know, my head was brushing against the ceiling of this venue and you're shoulder to shoulder with everyone and the acoustics are really bad. It was just like a little basement somewhere in London. It wasn't even a gig hall or anything. I don't even remember where it was, but...
Yeah, you're right. I mean, without kind of waxing lyrical on the state of the world as it is right now, obviously, we're being at gigs like that, and even if gigs start going ahead next year and venues are going to have to be just totally different and totally wide open and all that sort of thing. So I think those really intimate gigs, I think it's going to take a long time for those to come back onto the scene. And, you know, I wonder if we go deep enough into this lockdown scenario, not just in this country, but in the world, whether we'll start seeing true underground gigs again. This is a, you know, like really illegal gigs. You know, you get people going to raves and things like that in their hundreds. I don't know if you get people going in their dozens to, you know, illegal, you know, live music gigs. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens, because you can't keep that down for too long, can you, really?
That's awesome. No, you're right. And if they won't let it happen legitimately, enough
bands
are going to make it happen. Yeah, illegally. That's, I might. Well, I'm gonna keep my ear to the ground on that one. If I hear of any acts going on, I'll let you know, and we'll road trip.
Yeah, absolutely. Not that we're advocating any sort of, you know, anti-lockdown policy rules. I mean, we are, but we're not. So.
Yeah, be responsible, people. I mean.
Yeah, be responsible. Be responsible. Look after, you know, protect. Protect your loved ones, you know, make intelligent decisions is what we're saying.
Make intelligent decisions to go to illegal venues and gigs. Yeah, there's a difference, but I know people that are going to like 100-man raves that are getting shut down by huge police presences, and that's, to me, that's irresponsible. And there is a difference between that and going to what could be considered an intimate venue with several other people. But
I don't know, dude. It's such a grey area. I mean, there's real pros and cons to all of it, you know. I'm a big, big, big believer in personal freedom, and people should be allowed to do what they want. But then, you know, trying to determine the difference between a, you know, 600 person rave and a 100 person metal gig, I don't know. There's a lot of things that are the same. I know we don't want to get into this right now. You know, there's no right and wrong. We're right in the middle of everything, where the science is saying different things, and you know, we've just got to do the best you can, I think, right now.
Do the best you can. Those are great words to end the episode on, guys.
Yeah.
All you got to do the best that you can.
Follow your heart and your head.
Follow your heart, follow your head, do the best you can.
Yeah. If you've got this far, we always say this, if you've got this far, then well done and thank you. Well done first, because, you know.
Well done.
Yeah, well done. But thank you. And, you know, tune in next time when we'll be talking about other things.
We'll put our Instagram tags in the description below and the link to join the Discord as well. I'm hopefully going to try and get growing a little bit. As always, guys, thank you for listening very much. Stay in touch if you can. Send us a message. Here is Conan. We'll play us out with track 2 off their EP Horseback Battlehammer, entitled Satsumo. Have a good night, guys. Thank you.